It may be said that there is contradiction of fact in what the Vedas say about the demigods having bodies. But this is not true, because the demigods come into being in pursuance of the Vedic hymns. This fact is supported by the empirical evidence of Shruti and the logical evidence of Smriti. What the Vedas say about the demigods having bodies. Well, I guess the Vedas say the demigods do have bodies and describe those bodies. Someone may say, well, wait, demigods don't have bodies. They're superhuman, so they don't have bodies, someone may be arguing. But the Vedas describe the bodies of the demigods. Indra's body is like this. He holds a thunderbolt. He looks like this. He's got 1,000 eyes. And another demigod has 4 arms and this and that. Different descriptions of the bodies are in the Vedas. No contradiction of fact. You may think that demigods don't have any bodies because you never saw the bodies. And you think that because your body is a gross material thing and the demigods can't have such gross material bodies, you're presuming they can't have any bodies. That's your imperfect reasoning. But the Vedas describe those bodies. And not only are the Vedas true, but whatever bodies the demigods end up getting is because the creation of the demigods is according to the Vedas. The demigods are created according to the plan of the Vedas. So they're going to end up with exactly the kind of bodies that the Vedas say they have. And this fact is supported by the empirical evidence of Shruti and the logical evidence of Smriti. Well, why is Shruti called empirical evidence? Empirical usually means what you can perceive yourself, like pratyaksha, sensory perception. But this is scriptural perception. But it's direct in the same way. All you have to do is receive the message of the Vedas. You have to hear the words and you have to understand what they mean. The authority is there. They're authoritative as soon as you can understand what they mean. Therefore, it's empirical. Just perceive it. Perceive the Vedas. Hear the words. Understand their meaning. And the message is there, and it's self-evidently authoritative. That's empiric evidence. Just like the evidence of my eyes. I see there's a sun in the sky. That's empiric evidence. Visual. But I hear in the Vedas that Indra has a thunderbolt. That's empiric evidence coming from scripture. It's also direct, self-evident. Whereas the Smriti is called logical evidence. Yes? Okay. I'm sorry. Didn't mean to shout. Yes. Yes, coming from the auditory sense. But it's not just the sound. It's the meaning of the sound. Pratyaksha, Anuman, and Shabda. Where do you say it? Oh, that was my the Sanskrit, it was pratyaksha?
Yes.
Okay. So we can take the Vedas as a kind of special pratyaksha. Usually it's not divided like that. Usually shabda is a third category. But it is a kind of pratyaksha, although it's not a simple pratyaksha, it's not nirvikalpaka pratyaksha. You have to hear the Vedic sound, and you have to understand it also to get the message. You can hear the Vedas and recite them in a sacrifice and not have any idea what it means. It's effective in that way, but it doesn't convey any message. To get prama from the Vedas, you have to understand what the words mean. Yes?
Where does it say?
Okay. It's right up in the Sanskrit. I'm looking. Third line. Could you read it? Okay. Not the third line for me. Fourth line for Navana. So what's the first word you're starting with? Iti chain now, where's that? Oh wait, I'm looking in the wrong paragraph. No. Oh, okay, so italics. Shabda iti chain na tak. It's the Vedanta Sutra that's being quoted, okay? Shabda iti chain na tak prabhavad prachakshanu manabhyam, which is translated as, it may be said that there is contradiction of fact in what the Vedas say about the demigods having bodies, but this is not true, because the demigods come in being in pursuit of the Vedic hymns. And all the Sanskrit says is this is by Shruti, by Pratyaksha, and by Anuman. I think I'm following the Govinda Bhasha in identifying the Pratyaksha and Anuman actually as Shruti and Smriti. It's not that you should look in a telescope and you'll see the demigods, you know, Pratyaksha. And Anuman is you should sit down and think about it, come up with some mathematical formula. No, the Pratyaksha we're talking about here and the Anuman are the Shruti and the Smriti. I've taken the liberty of translating the Vedanta Sutra quotes here from the Govinda Bhasha rather than my trying to figure it out from the dictionary. You need a commentary to understand the Vedanta Sutra, so I chose to use Baladeva Vidyabhushan's explanations to be able to figure out what the sutras actually mean. And I've added, you know, things between the words just to make it coherent. Otherwise, you give a strictly literal translation, the reader can't understand what it's saying. Okay, continuing, and then we'll read the commentary and then have questions. Tasmad vedakyam shastram pramanam tal tal lakshana hinatvad tad virudatvad cha avaidikam tu shastram na pramanam. Therefore the scripture known as the Vedas is an authoritative source of knowledge. Sanskrit doesn't have articles. It doesn't say a or the. I could have said the, but that means it's the only one. So to be a little open about it, I said it's an authoritative source of knowledge. Continuing, but scripture that is not Vedic lacks authority because it lacks the various defining features of the Vedas and because it contradicts the Vedas. If you have some scripture that is within the scope of what the Vedas are supposed to be, it's Vedic, it's emulating the Vedas. And if it doesn't contradict the Vedas, then we can say it's also Vedic. It's in pursuance of the Vedas. But we're talking about non-Vedic texts that don't fit the pattern of Vedic scriptures, and they actually contradict the Vedas, that we reject. They're not authoritative. Commentary. The Advaitavad Vedanta Bhasha mentioned here is the Shariraka Bhasha of Shankaracharya, and the Vedanta commentary of Ramanuja is the Sri Bhasha. Most traditional Indian schools of thought presume that the conventional relationship between words and what they express, rather than being created by humans, originates from a higher intelligence. It's a very naive theory of language to propose that human beings make up the meaning between the words, the relationship between words and their meanings. It doesn't work like that in real languages, except for extra words added, names and a few technical terms. Most words in a language are not created by the human beings, or the connection between the sounds and their meanings. And in Indian traditional thought, I say most, I can't think of anybody who denies that the relationship between words and their meanings is something natural and original, not created by human beings. I don't know if you know of a philosophy in India where they say that it's not? I don't know. Okay. The schools that recognize the perfect authority of the Vedas, now not every school of thought recognizes the perfect authority of the Vedas. Bhaktivinoda Thakur is of the opinion that only the Vaishnava Vedanta school really, really accepts the authority of the Vedas. That other darshans, even Mimamsa's interpretation of the Vedas ritualistically, even that and other schools that give lip service to the Vedas, that they don't really have true faith in the Vedic authority. They're just pretending to have faith. Only the Vaishnava Vedanta. Anyway, we say here, the schools that recognize the perfect authority of the Vedas believe furthermore that the language of the Vedas, including the relationship between its words and their meanings, is eternal. Not only is the actual text of the Vedas eternal, but the words don't change their meanings. We read Shakespeare, and we're reading the original Shakespeare, you know, from the manuscript he wrote 500 years ago. We have copies of it, but the words have changed their meanings. We have to go back and study what the words used to mean. Many of the words don't mean the same thing anymore. But the Vedas don't change like that. Not only the words don't change, but the meaning of the words doesn't change. It's eternal. As Jaimini Sutra, that's the Mimamsa Sutra, states, the connection between words and their meanings is natural. And that's the Sanskrit for that sutra from the Mimamsa is... Well, it's not here. Oh, because this is the commentary. Okay. I didn't quote the Sanskrit. Something like Alpatiki Shabda Arta Yor Sambandha, something like that. It's the fifth sutra, 115 in the Mimamsa Sutras. Okay, I may have gone through that too fast. Any questions? Yes?
I just wanted to ask regarding Shariraka term.
So yes?
You explained it as it kind of gives a hint to the idea that the Lord is the soul and the energies of the Lord are his body. So Shariraka, coming from Sharir.
Can I just tell you one thing?
Yeah.
In the Taittiriya Upanishad, there's the description of the five koshas. And after each kosha, it says that there's another kosha, like the Anamaya kosha, but beyond the Anamaya kosha is the Pranamaya kosha. The Pranamaya kosha is the Sharira. You can take the Anamaya to be the body and the Pranamaya to be the soul. The soul is called Sharira. It's vritti form, it means that which has a body. So Sharira means the soul that has a body. Okay.
So we mean it to be Lord Narayana.
Yes,
or, you know, the energies.
In Upanishadic terms, it's Brahman. Yes,
Brahman.
The truth. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So
So the Upanishads, the Vedanta, talks about the absolute truth, Brahman. And the book about him is Shariraka. But it's him as the embodiment of his energies. Brahman without any energies, it would be a very short book. In fact, there'd be no words in it. If it really just talked about Nirguna Brahman, then there'd be nothing should be said. Okay. But the whole Upanishads and then the Vedanta Sutra describing the Upanishads is talking about Brahman and his energies. That's Shariraka, but Shariraka Shastra.
Yeah. Another question regarding the words in innate connection with the meanings. So. Oh, and I think it was described in just two quotes above, how by uttering the word earth, he created the earth, means that every object actually it has its vibration.
In the original Vedic language.
In the original Vedic language. Now when
because, you know, in Russian, zimla is a different word.
So it misses that link. No more.
It's a translation of the link into a different language, you know, a secondary language. But the original language See, Russian didn't always exist. So you can't say the relationship between words and their meaning is eternal in a language that isn't in itself eternal. But the eternal language of the Vedas, the relationship is really eternal.
So this statement...
And God at the beginning of creation can use Vedic Sanskrit, say earth, and earth will come out of that.
So this innate connection of words and their meanings applies only to Sanskrit, not to other languages.
Let's say in other languages, if they're not eternal, it's innate as long as they exist.
It's also
it's a relationship that as long as from the very beginning of the language, the meaning was fixed. That's not even true in the actual development of languages, historical development. Words shift and meanings shift a lot. So really, it isn't. For mundane languages, there's a lot of changing going on. From one century to another, the same word can have a different meaning, or it'll be replaced by another word. I mean, there are a lot of words in Russian that they're actually French, German, or English. They were borrowed at a certain time. Before that, there was no word for it, which is unlikely, or they had a native Slavic word for it before. So a different word was substituted for the same meaning. In the historical language, and it happens to all languages. Languages do that a lot. They like to borrow from other languages. It's just a way to keep up with the times and changing circumstances. They just drop words and pick up other words with the same meanings. Or the same word and the meaning changes. That happens a lot. In English it happens a lot. We don't realize. Look at the Oxford English Dictionary and see the history of common words and how most of them meant something completely different 400 years ago. There's something different there. In mundane languages, it isn't so exactly fixed.
So basically we see the process of distortion that was going on.
Imperfect languages.
And as much as the languages get distorted, that much that innate connection is being lost.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes. Well, I don't know if it's a matter of degrees. If you enter the material world, then you have a material body, not a spiritual body. And it's not a question of degrees. It means it's not the real thing.
Okay.
Not 50% real or 75% real. It's not real at all. Yeah. It's not eternal at all. It's always changing. That's material nature. So material languages, the connection between words and the meaning isn't fixed. Isn't really innate. It's innate in a way, in the sense that we don't create the meanings. But still, whoever does create the meanings changes his mind a lot.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's innate, like subjectively innate, not objectively innate.
You can say that, yeah.
Just
in the sense that we're not the ones usually who make up the meanings.
Yeah.
It just happens beyond our control. Yes.
I'm sorry.
Yes, go ahead.
Think here also. Just if you could clarify what you mean by various defining features of the Vedas in the last sentence.
Okay, let's look at the Sanskrit for it.
Tatalakshana.
Well, that's not very specific. Because of being deprived of this and that lakshana. So there are certain... it's not specified here. We'll have to, infer what we mean by this. What Jiva Goswami means by being devoid of these various lakshanas. Well, it must be lakshanas of the Vedas, because we're talking about being non-Vedic. So it must be missing certain lakshanas. It must be certain lakshanas the Vedas have. What are the lakshanas the Vedas have? What's special about the Vedas that distinguish it from the daily newspaper? Parashaya, okay, it doesn't have an author. Eternal, doesn't change, and it's perfectly authoritative, doesn't say anything that might be false or distorted. There is an innate connection, there's an unchanging connection between the words and their meanings. Those are Vedic characteristics. So some other non-Vedic Shastra doesn't have those characteristics. Especially, they don't express infallible truth. There can be intentional distortion, accidental distortion, incomplete understanding, expressed in the non-Vedic Shastras. In other words, they're written by fallible persons, and therefore they're full of mistakes. Wrong ideas, vague ideas, missing ideas, things that don't follow one from another. Whereas in the Vedas, everything is perfect. There's no false statement, there's no vague, incomprehensible statement. Everything is comprehensible and true. Yeah, where's the mic? Okay, Sarvadeva, you go first with the mic.
Okay, excuse me. So, this question related to Nityananda Prabhu, so I just want to ask it now. For example, we have some basic set of things which exist in this material world, and we have some relationship between these things which are to be described. So, and therefore we have original language which already has this perfect explanation and expression of all the things, and this language is Sanskrit. And also, is it correct, Mr. Nian?
So far. I don't know if Sanskrit is, first of all, describing just the material things.
Yes.
Originally, Sanskrit is describing things in the spiritual world. And then you can carry it over to the material world, because all the things in the material world are reflections of the original things in the spiritual world. Mm-hmm. But what Sanskrit is originally describing is spiritual reality.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's like a perfect description of all reality, either spiritual or material, which you can experience.
Yes.
So, and but I don't understand about material languages. Because the same sets of relationships and things in this material world also has to be described, and if they don't accept Sanskrit, they have to use some other language. And how
do you have to? Is Sanskrit inadequate to describe everything material? Because it's just a spiritual language, and therefore can't handle material things. I think material things, because they're only reflections of the spiritual realities, don't really need a separate language. They can be described by the spiritual language. The spiritual language can describe everything material also.
Yes, I understand that it can be also described by Sanskrit, but
can be
described. Yeah, and it should be described actually by Sanskrit. But what is the reason that so many languages appeared in this world? And how they appeared.
There are different theories about that.
Yeah. Was it because people needed some means of relationship and description of these things, and therefore they created their own language?
Well, people don't create their own languages. We were just discussing how... See, in general, people don't create their own languages. The only languages that get created are things like Esperanto, which are not real languages, artificial languages. Real languages don't get created by... We may add a few words to a language, but we don't create a whole language. Nobody does it. Not a real language. The real languages in the world weren't created by finite intelligence, or not by human intelligence.
Coming to my
question. But you can rephrase that to avoid that part, yeah?
Yes. So, and how we can understand... Who created this language? All those languages. Is it a variation of Sanskrit? Are they derived from Sanskrit, or the separate creations in according to level of consciousness of particular group of people?
Well, this is getting off on a tangent, but because I wanted to just comment on something, now I forgot what it was. So now we're going off on a different tangent, but. Because now I'm just speculating. Sanskrit's the original language. We can say that all languages are derived from Sanskrit. Now there is a family of languages that are related to Sanskrit in a noticeable way. They share many of the same words, and you can see traces of the same grammar. But there are other group families of languages in the world where there's no visible connection. The words are all different and the grammar is all different, completely different. If there's a connection with Sanskrit, it's on a more basic, invisible level. That the basic patterns of language, like what it means to be a verb and what it means to be a noun and what the basic structure of a sentence is at an abstract level. That's derived, you can say, from the original language. But all the externals may have completely changed so that none of the words are the same and none of the grammar is the same. Just the basic structure of language is the same. You can say that derives from the original language, okay. But there's nothing visible that you could trace, you could see as coming from the original language. There are many languages in the world like that, that look completely different. But they still have the same basic structure under the surface. Now, what was the first thing you were talking about?
Who created all these material languages? How they appeared in this world? What is the origin of them?
That we don't have too much information of, who actually makes the languages. It's God's intelligence, whether he does it himself or delegates it to someone else. It's not human beings, maybe demigods, or maybe God himself just, you know, planned out all the languages.
Also, it's a little bit...
Like the whole structure of creation is in the mind of God. Before Lord Brahma was ever born, it was already all figured out by Lord Narayan. And Brahma is just, you know, inheriting the ideas that Narayan had in his own head, including all the languages in the world.
And I remember...
What was the first thing you said, though? Before the... Okay.
Well, basically, it was a long discussion. So, and here we mention the Lord of Creation. So it can be original Supreme Personality of Godhead, and it can be Lord Brahma, because he did this practical work of creation. And I remember one explanation.
The Vedas use the term Prajapati, and so does the Bhagavad Gita in one place, and it can be interpreted both ways. Mm-hmm.
So both Lord Narayana or Lord Brahma?
Yeah, well, we know the history. We know what Narayan did and what Brahma did. In a sense, each of them is the Lord of creation, just at different phases of the creation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Yes?
I have two questions.
Two questions.
The first one is, the first paragraph that was translated, on this theme that the creation has begun from sound, the Advaita...
Okay, what's the English? Say it again. On this theme, okay.
The creation has become from sound. Then he quotes, the lords of creatures send forth these demigods and the human beings to take pleasure in bodies containing blood, and the moon-like forefathers. What is this proving, like this quotation, what is this proving?
What is it?
Was it supposed, what's the point being made in this?
Okay. It's some Shruti. The abbreviation here is CR. I don't remember what that is. I didn't fix that up yet. Actually, in my copy of the file, all these abbreviations are spelled out, but you have an older copy here. Anyway, in the CR, whatever that is, some sort of Shruti, this statement is there. It's a description, a graphic description of the creation by the Prajapati.
But how's it
the point is... that the Vedas describe how the Prajapati created the world, that description existed before he ever did it, before there ever was that Prajapati. The description comes first, and then the Prajapati follows the script later on.
So that's how creation begins from sound, because it's there already in the Vedas.
I don't think this statement is talking about creating from
sound. Yeah,
I see. Okay, hold on. I'm sorry? Do you see where the connection with sound is? Yeah. Are people called manushyas because they're asrigrams?
I think just like in the second quote, he says, Sabur iti vyaharat
bhunim. He said the word bhu.
Yeah, so now in the first quote, he said the word etaha and he created the devas. He said the word Ashrigran and he created the manushyas.
Oh, and it's his quote mark.
Indavaha and he created the pitris.
Well, that's missing in the translation. Okay, can I make a note about that and fix it? Thank you. You caught a mistake in the translation. These are actually, he's actually saying these words. That's important, okay.
And my second question...
Oh, no, no, you gotta let me write this down first. Actually says... what does he say first? Etaha. And Asrigran and so on. Fix the translation. Okay, it'll make more sense when I fix the translation. Go ahead and ask your other question.
Can you explain, you've explained why did he use empirical to mean shruti? Because you just perceive it. Can you explain why is the shruti called logical evidence?
Yeah, okay. You see that the Sanskrit just says prajakshin anuman. And I've rendered that as shruti and smriti, and given the hint of the explanation. I presume, I can't remember, I have to go look. I think I got this, because I did this for all the citations of Vedanta Sutra. I checked them all with Govinda Bhasha to give a thorough explanation of what each one means. I used Govinda Bhasha. So I must be getting this idea from the Govinda Bhasha that pratyaksha means shruti and anuman means smriti. Now you want to know why? I can't remember what Govinda Bhasha said. I can only guess. You want to know why the smriti is called logical evidence like that? And why shruti is called empirical evidence?
Yeah.
Okay, I tried to give an idea of that already. I don't know if I can do any better. It's a guess, because I don't have the Govinda Bhasha in front of me. You just hear the shruti. You hear the shruti, and if you can understand the words, then you've received the knowledge. That's all that's required. You don't need to deduce anything further from it. All you have to do to get the knowledge from the Vedas, all you have to do is hear and understand them. So that's empirical. It's a directly received knowledge. Just put it in your ear and process what the words mean. And that's it. The knowledge is there. Whereas in smriti, you've got to go through a process of inference. Apparently, that the authority of smriti is not self-evident. Okay, the smriti says this. How is this in agreement with the Vedas? How is this in agreement with Vedic philosophy as we know it? How is it to be reconciled? How is it to be understood in context? You have to undergo all these thought processes to digest smriti. Smriti cannot be received in the same direct way as a shruti. You got to think about it and draw some deductive conclusions. That's why it's called anuman. That's my guess. We can... look in, what is this sutra? 1328? We can look in 1328 of Govinda Bhasha and see what Balaji Vidyabhushan said about that.
Do you have a better guess?
Thank you.
You know, the smriti is smriti is derivative. The authority of smriti is dependent on the authority of shruti. Even if smriti can be understood, you can understand what the words are saying on your own. The truth of them is dependent on the authority of the Vedas. Because the smriti is faithful to the Vedas, therefore it's truthful. Or we know it to be truthful. In that sense, it's secondary, it's derivative. And what's the meaning of the word anuman? Doctor, what does anuman actually mean literally? No, mana doesn't mean mind there. Mana means measurement, or rather perception, or rather pramana. Prama, the act of knowing something correctly, is called prama. So the direct or original, first valid perception is what you get from your senses. Then you have a derivative, a secondary perception by the extension of logic. I don't see any fire on the mountain, but I can see the smoke, and from that I can deduce the fire. Anuman is a secondary understanding. So the smriti is a secondary source of knowledge, derivative and based on the shruti. In that sense, it's anuman, that it's derivative. But to really get it right, we'd have to look at the Govinda Bhasha and see why he used these words and whether he explained it further. Why he identifies pratyaksha as shruti and anuman as smriti. Let's see what he says about it. If someone can find me the book, I'll look at it. I think maybe I have it in my own era, the first volume of Vedanta Sutra. If I have it, I'll look at it. If it's back in the library, somebody can get it for me.
Just to put this whole paragraph into the context of the whole portion of what we are reading, is that this is the main sentence in the whole passage. Thus accepting as axiomatic the relationship, because
we conclude that the Vedas have independent authority.
So basically what he's doing is, I understand, again and again he's trying to show this very point from different perspectives. Is
that the authority of the Vedas are supreme and they're independent.
And here he's doing it through showing how their meaning,
the meanings are eternal.
Eternally established
by
God. And
the whole creation. Yeah. We may say, well, you know, a system of thought is valid if it explains the reality in front of us. But the reality in front of you was created by from the Vedas. You know, the reality is just a reflection of the Vedas. So certainly the Vedas are authoritative. The whole universe that you're concerned about explaining is just an emanation from the Vedas. What is it, you know, what's your criterion for a good system of thought? Is one that explains concrete reality. But concrete reality is just created by the pattern of the Vedas. So that pattern, that thought of the Vedas is the original authority. It's the original truth. Why is he saying all this? Why is he even bothering to prove the authority of the Vedas? Why? Why are we dealing with that now? What's the context? What's the higher purpose of it? Well, yeah, we want to know where we're going to get our knowledge from. Yeah. Yeah, we're going to have to Vedas is going to turn into Bhagavatam. Okay. Yes, ma'am. That will be discussed soon. We're getting into that. When we get back to the Sandarbha, we're stuck now in the long discussion about the nature of Shabda. Once we get out of that, we go back to the original text of the Sandarbhas, the next topic will be that. The importance of the Itihasas and Puranas. Not as a substitute or replacement, but as explanation of the Vedas, support of the Vedas. Damodar, go public.
Just as we have now in Sanskrit, we learn words like a word, the name for a computer.
Okay, so or Antarjala, internet.
Internet, was it? Antar?
Antarjala.
Antarjala.
Jala is a net, or a network.
Okay.
The inside network, internet.
So these are creation of new words. But
it's a creation of words, but it's just like putting together gold in a mountain and getting golden mountain.
Yeah,
it's not. It's, you know, just putting together old pieces to make a new word.
It's not. It's not new. It's not new ideas.
Yes.
It's not new ideas.
You could have a word that you can't figure out, even pieces to put together, and you'd have to come up with something completely new.
Okay.
There's a word, kramelika. that comes up in Jiva Goswami's, I think in his, not Jiva Goswami, Rupa Goswami, in the Lalita Madhava, in one verse, the word Kramelika means camel. There are other words for camel in Sanskrit, but this word is Latin. Kramelika is actually, you know, the word camel leopard is a Sanskrit word, I mean a Latin word. And the Sanskrit language has picked it up and turned it into Kramelika. So Rupa Goswami used the word, borrowed from Latin. So sometimes you do get completely new constructions, you know, into Sanskrit. They can be introduced.
But these are like, we can term it modern Sanskrit.
Yeah, it's like, you know, but human beings can add a little icing on the top, can add a few extra words. That's allowed.
But the Sanskrit...
The basic language is eternal.
The Sanskrit found in the Veda, in the listed texts of the Vedas.
Yeah, so like you might say America Desha or something. You can use add the word America that doesn't exist in Sanskrit.
But the basic is eternal. Okay.
Yeah.
The Sanskrit found in.
It's usually just technical terms and proper names can be created. Other words can't. Yes. Just like I have a son. I could call him Duryodhana, which means something in Sanskrit, or I can make up a name that doesn't mean anything. I can do that also. You're allowed to do that. Names don't have to actually be words that already exist. You can create a new word to be somebody's name. If I have a son, I can call him whatever I want in Sanskrit, even make up a new word. But that's for proper names. Yes?
Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, there is a list of qualities of Krishna, 64, and I take it to mean that these are the basic qualities of Krishna in the spiritual world as well. So
yes.
One of them is Vividha Bhuta Bhasha Vit, means one who knows all wonderful languages.
Yes.
Do we take it to mean that in the spiritual world there are many languages, actually just one, and Krishna speaks them all?
Yes.
So not just Sanskrit.
There are other languages just for fun, for pastime, pleasure. There's other languages also.
Like languages of the birds, they don't speak Sanskrit there, do they? Or just chirp?
They may also speak Sanskrit, but they, you know, what's the fun of birds speaking Sanskrit? You have enough pundits speaking
no
Sanskrit.
No fun, I can
so
tell
So let
you.
The birds chirp. That's more appropriate.
And
you know, Madhu Mangal, let him speak Magadhi Prakrit. You know, that's more appropriate for a joker, for a Vidushika. And let the lady speak, you know, Shurasani Prakrit. It's just for, you know, for pleasure, for variety.
What about Bengali language? Because we take it to mean that Navadvipa is also one of the integral parts of...
Yes, and Prabhupada said they speak Bengali there.
So it's also one of the languages spoken in the spiritual world.
Okay, yes.
I want to ask about Russian.
Okay. Anyway, there's ISKCON in the spiritual world, and there's... Mayapur festival, most of the devotees are Russians.
The GBC is in Spanish. Ask about the understanding which I got also from some descriptions of the levels of language. I think in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali there are different levels of the sound, and on the grossest level the words and their meanings and the concepts we denote by those meanings are different things. But on the deepest level, I don't remember exactly, is it Karanadeh or something which is connected inseparably from the nature of objects. In other words, by describing on that subtle level or operating on that subtle level different objects, a yogi can actually manipulate the reality around it, which is connected.
Padini talks about that?
As far as I remember, yeah.
Yes?
Or is it Rigveda? No, but there are some yogic texts. Rigveda may have given an original concept.
There are yogic texts. Shankaracharya quoted. Shankaracharya had a few words of his own to talk about the different levels of the emanation of language from the heart.
Well, the Bhagavatam talks about four different languages.
Those are different levels of language. The, you know, the nada, and then the vaikari, and the mukri. But does Panini discuss that? No.
Anyway,
maybe in the Mahabhasha there may be some reference to that.
Maybe I'm wrong, but my question is not about that. My question is about taking Sanskrit as the original source of all languages. Looks like if we take...
You can take it.
if we bring this concept in, then we can meaningfully talk how Sanskrit is the basis of all languages, not on the level of grammar or etymology, but on the level of the real concepts inside our minds and inside our consciousness, which are the same, because that's what makes for a successful language study. We have to switch off translating things from one language to another, but operate on the level of concepts rather than...
Let's say this, that language is a model of thought. Language expresses thought, either internally or externally. You either think or you speak, and that is a reflection of what you're thinking. So Sanskrit is the original natural way of expressing thought. Other languages are artificial attempts to do something, to do it a different way. They may be close to Sanskrit, they may be apparently no connection with Sanskrit, but actually on the deep level, the original way of expressing thought is the Sanskrit language.
In other words, if we do not discuss just the grossest level of the language, the phonetics and semantics and etymology and everything...
We won't see the connection unless we go deeper.
Right, if you talk about concepts, because if we take that the world around us is...
There's two things, concepts and deep syntax.
Yes.
The basic structure of thought, of sentences, which express thoughts. The basic idea of a verb and a subject... You find that practically in every language. So that's deep. Just the syntax of verb subject.
Exactly, because it reflects the original nature, the original world we belong
original
to.
Original pattern of thought, actually.
The original world we belong to, even before coming to this world.
Yes.
It could go that deep. In other words, because the world around us is created after the Vedas as a pattern, and also Krishna says in the Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th canto, that the Vedic sound is like lotus fiber inside our hearts, inside the soul.
Yes.
So it kind of connects. And then other things like what kind of language you speak, Chinese or Russian or Sanskrit, just an external layer on it, just to make us enable us to communicate on the gross level while we have material bodies.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Like mathematics. Mathematics is an entirely artificial language, it's a semantics, but it operates some inbuilt, some innate principles of this world, and that's why it works perfectly.
Yes.
Even though it's completely artificial.
Yes.
Or any programming language. Programming language also gives operations. We describe different functions or verbs and different substances.
Yes, but originally it's expressing human thought.
Right.
You know, a program is expressing the intentions of the programmer, although it's expressing it in artificial language. So you can say all the other languages besides Sanskrit are relatively artificial. Not that human beings created them, but the demigods or whoever created them tried to make something new. Like Vishwamitra wanted to create a species of life. So he tried to make another kind of cow, but it ended up as a buffalo. He forgot to put sweat glands on it. So, you know, like that, an imitation.
Some people, like, I don't know, Russian,
they speak like buffalo, no.
Buffalo languages, because it was an imitation of the original one or something.
Okay. Anyway, whatever language you were brought up with as an infant, that's the one you're going to like. It's just conditioning. We stop here? Thank you, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Shri Tattva Sandarbha Ki Jai.